Welcome to the Economics Explored podcast, a frank and fearless exploration of important economic issues. I'm your host, Gene Tunney. I'm a professional economist and former Australian Treasury official. The aim of this show is to help you better understand the big economic issues affecting all our lives. We do this by considering the theory, evidence, and by hearing a wide range of views. I'm delighted that you can join me for this episode. Please check out the show notes for relevant information. Now on to the show. Hello and welcome to the show. In this special highlights episode, we're revisiting one of the biggest issues of our time, net zero emissions. Over the last 6 years of the show, some of my guests have called for urgent action. They're pushing for net zero, but others have raised serious doubts. My goal is to give you the best insights from all sides of the debate. A special thanks to Lumo Coffee for sponsoring this episode. This top-quality organic coffee from the highlands of Peru is packed with healthy antioxidants. Economics Explored listeners can enjoy a 10% discount. Details are in the show notes. Also, check out the show notes for relevant links and any clarifications. If you have any questions or thoughts on this episode or other recent episodes, please get in touch by emailing me at contact@economicsexplored.com. I'd love to hear from you. Okay, to start with, let's hear from economist Nikki Hutley, who joined me to discuss the costs of climate change. This clip is from episode 25 from early March 2020, just before the COVID lockdown. At the time, Nikki was a partner at Deloitte Access Economics. Now she's an independent consultant. Nikki argues that the cost of doing nothing about climate change could be astronomical. She argues that extreme weather and economic disruption are already costing us dearly. Nikki argues that while there will be transition costs from acting on climate change, they will be far smaller than the costs of inaction. Let's listen to what Nikki has to say.
So there's a few things. The first one, of course, is what we call climate or transition risk, the physical risk of climate change. So we're talking about the impact of cyclones, floods, the bushfires that we've just seen, and the physical damage that does directly to the environment, to our buildings, but then also the downstream impact. So if, for example, supermarket is cut off by flood, then that's going to impact those that are buying supermarket. It's going to be affecting those who might purchase from the supermarket, and that's not just individuals, but before people did as well. But you can see that there are all these impacts from an economic point of view. And then on top of that, of course, with all the cost of repairs. And then on top of that, we've got things like mental health challenges for people who've been through the trauma of these events. We've got, kids can't get to school or people can't get to their job. They might be tied up in having to deal with insurance, et cetera. So you can see very quickly that costs are not just the economic impact, but the physical damage that's done from an extreme weather event that related to climate change, but also all of these downstream. And of course, I haven't even got into what happens even if you don't actually have one of those extreme events. But for example, you might have drought, flooding, extreme heat days that affect people's health.
Okay, so is that the major way that the costs of climate change are realised? It's through an increase in severe weather events and also through these hotter days, and that affects people's health? Please go on. That's what I'm trying to get at. Like, what are those linkages? What is causing these costs?
So then in addition to that, we've got what we call transition risk. And irrespective of what governments do, although they can pay a part in this, we know that there is a cost to economies, to individuals, to firms, to the economies as a whole, from the impact of transitioning in climate to much higher degrees of temperature. And that might mean things like the cost of your electricity has gone up. We can't provide certain goods, but also industry is closed down. So there are other types of risk. There's both physical risk and the transition risk, all of which add to the cost of doing business, as well as to the actual impact borne by an increase in extreme weather events. The extreme weather events are the ones where we've done most of our modelling, though. And if you think about some of the work we did for the Business Roundtable on climate change, on disaster resilience, you were talking at close to $40 billion a year over the next couple of decades. So not that far away, and it seems to be accelerating.
How does the cost of acting compare with the cost of not acting? Do we have any feel for that based on the scientific research and on economic analysis, Nikki?
We do, but at the moment we have it contained in certain areas. But if I go back to the time of Gano and the sorts of modelling that Lloyd Axworth Economics was doing at that time around this, everything that we did around the transition cost suggested that we could probably lose about, transition under an emissions trading scheme, it could potentially cost us around maybe up to 1.5-2% of GDP over a prolonged period of growth. If we are then going to get the extreme weather event that we are now being forecast by UN climate panels, etc., if we're going to get higher average temperatures that are going to destroy large parts of Australian industry, think agriculture as just one of those, but think potential risk to, as I said, commercial business, to the activity that goes on inside those buildings, to infrastructure and the parts of the economy that rely on roads, on telecommunication. The cost of inaction are many, many multiples over time and pounding than the cost of implementing something as simple as an emissions trading scheme. That's not to say that those who will lose jobs will not feel it terribly. As with everything, at the individual level, these things are far more catastrophic than that. But we need to look out at a global or at least a national economic level and say the costs of not acting are estimated to be, even though they're not confined, they are likely to be many multiples of the cost of action. And that if we couple action with things like training, with skills, with investment in alternative industries, so that we give people who are affected a chance to regroup and recover, as they have from textile clothing, as it were, as they have done from the car industry. 80% of people have had from the car industry now are in alternative employment in Victoria. If we can provide that right support, we can minimise the harm that's caused by transitioning, and we can maximise the huge benefit, because it will be more than the coal industry that goes, that faces these dramatic changes if we don't do something about climate change now.
Okay, so that was Nikki Hutley on the costs of climate change. If you've got thoughts on what Nikki had to say or what I had to say, think about getting in touch via the email contact@economicsexplored.com. Now we'll go to another clip in which Tony Wood, who's the energy program director at the Grattan Institute, Tony tells us what net zero actually means, and he has some thoughts on how we can get there. He laid out the definition of net zero and the technologies that might help us achieve it. Tony and I spoke in episode 108, which came out in October 2021. I'll put a link in the show notes to that in case you want to go back and listen to the full episode. So Tony points out that some of the solutions that are available now are relatively cheap, in his view, things like electric vehicles,
others like hydrogen and sequestering carbon in the soil. They're still expensive, but they could become viable with innovation. And then there are more speculative ideas like red algae to reduce methane from cattle. Tony also notes nuclear power, while costly, could play a role if renewable storage solutions prove too difficult. Let's hear from Tony now.
I guess at one stage it's worthwhile just briefly reflecting on what net zero actually means, because it's a term that's only emerged relatively recently. I mean, we used to talk about certain levels of CO2 emissions or certain temperature increases, and of course net zero is related to temperature increases, but the concept of net zero sounds a bit, you know, it's become almost part of the general conversation, yet I'm not sure many people know what net zero means. What it literally means is that we have to return the global climate to what it used to be before the industrial and agricultural revolutions. That is, every ton of greenhouse gases that is put into the atmosphere by humans and other animals is taken out of the atmosphere by plants and oceans. That's it. And when we did that, when the world used to work that way, we had a stable climate. Now, what we've done is managed to screw that up over the last several hundred years. And the objective of net zero is to get back there. And the reason it's net is because it's pretty well recognized that getting back to absolute zero is almost impossible, if not effectively so. So that means we have to get as low as we possibly can. And then whatever's left above zero has to be offset with negatives. That is, taking emissions out of the atmosphere, which is a technology challenge in itself. The question is, how far can we get down towards zero before we have to start then offsetting out what remains of our emissions with something else?
Okay. And so what are those ways of getting it out or offsetting it? That's things like offsets. Is it not clearing land or protecting forests? Could it be direct capture of CO2 from the atmosphere? Have you had a look at those sort of things?
Most of what we do so far and have been doing isn't so much about removing emissions, greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. It's about reducing the amount we're putting into the atmosphere. So when we, for example, have made a lot of progress in the last 5 to 10 years on reducing emissions from our electricity system, we've basically been moving away from coal and towards renewables. Now, that is reducing the emissions, right?
Yeah.
Similarly, if we go to electric vehicles for our transport, that would be the same thing. The things that actually remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere, generally speaking, there's 3 or 4, and not very many. One is planting trees and then hoping those trees stay there for a long time. Of course, there's trees don't necessarily, so there's a question of what happens with those trees. Secondly, there is what's called re-establishing soil carbon. And that is, the idea is that over the last couple of hundred years, as a result of agriculture, we have been reducing the amount of carbon in our soil, which has impacts on the soil fertility and therefore even on farming. And so re-establishing that carbon in the soils would be not only good for the environment from a carbon perspective, but would also be good for farming productivity. The third area is, and you mentioned it, Gene, that is direct air capture. The idea basically can sound a little bit like engineering gone mad, but it's basically huge vacuum cleaners sucking CO2 effectively out of the atmosphere, absorbing that into some sort of chemical, possibly then recreating CO2, and then doing something else with it. And that's where this direct air capture technology gets linked with carbon capture and storage, because the idea is, once you've captured the CO2 from the atmosphere, I'm remembering this is an atmosphere that's got, even though we talk about it and worry about it a lot, the concentration of the CO2 is in a couple of hundred parts per million. So getting that level of CO2 out of the atmosphere is not a trivial process. But then once you've got it, you either bury it deep underground, or you do something even more prospective but equally challenging, and that is to turn it into something else, like turn CO2, if you're anybody on this listening to this podcast as a chemist, turning CO2 into CO3 or carbonate, sodium bicarbonate, magnesium carbonate, calcium carbonate, which is limestone, all those sorts of stuff, some of which could be used as building material. So that's the concept. Now, of all those direct air cap, of all those carbon removal processes, they all tend to either be relatively low cost, but difficult to prove and difficult to scale up.
Yeah.
We don't want to plant, you know, as Matt Canavan says, we don't want to replace all of our farming lands with forest because that would have a huge impact on our food production and also on our regional and some rural towns. But so there's that one. The direct air capture is right now really expensive and there's a lot of potential issues around. Can we store that CO2 underground the way we would like to think we can? And soil carbon also is quite problematic in terms of how do you get the carbon into the soil and how do you make it stay there? Because even the changing climate itself is contributing to the loss of carbon from our soil. So offsetting, when I describe it that way, sounds like a really big challenge down the track. We don't have to be doing it today because most of our activity today could be concentrated on reducing emissions. Mm. But ultimately, as we get closer to the points where reducing emissions further is very hard, then offsetting will become important. So getting on top of the technologies now is the most important thing we can do with offsetting.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ben and I have been looking at, what was that product called from CSIRO?
Red algae.
Yes.
It's the algae that reduces methane production in cows' guts by up to 80%.
Oh, yeah, that's with the cattle. That's reducing the emissions. I was thinking of the air capture thing too, the CSIRO.
Airthena,
yep. So that's one thing we've looked at for we've looked at the economics of that, and potentially that could be promising if you can do it on if they can reduce the cost per unit to our customers, it could end up being quite a good solution. So yeah, just wait and see. There's such a huge need for technological innovation. So I was reading Bill Gates's book on how to avert a climate disaster, and it seemed to be that in every area we need to innovate in. We need innovation. We need it in industrial processes. We need it in energy still. We need it in battery technology. We need it in potentially in pumped hydro. There's all sorts of innovation that we could do there. It sounds like we might need it in that capturing the carbon too, and in agriculture. I mean, Ben was mentioning red algae to try and reduce the methane emissions from cattle, and because that's a major source of emissions in ag. Is it the fact that we just need all this technological innovation that hasn't occurred yet, or is there stuff sitting on the shelf that we can use to reduce emissions now, and it's just a matter of our willingness to pay for it?
Well, I think that's a good way to phrase it, I think, Gene, and I think it's actually a mixture of the way we think about it is three things. Firstly, there are those things we know about already, some of which yep. we've already started to do but need to be scaled up dramatically, which are relatively low cost. An obvious one, for example, would be battery electric vehicles. I mean, they're already cheaper to run than petrol cars,
yep.
and they'll very shortly be cheaper to buy as well. So they're the sort of things that we should be encouraging very strongly, and we wrote a report about transport along those lines. So there's those. So every sector has something like that. There are things we can do on farm that would reduce emissions. Not the algae stuff yet, but other things on, because a lot of activity on farm is associated with the way we treat manure, the way we use fertilizer, the way farmers use diesel tractors, all that sort of stuff. Every sector's got some of those. Then there are those things which are pretty well known, but right now are expensive. So, for example, a lot of things associated with the possible roles that hydrogen could play in replacing natural gas, not only in energy, but more particularly as a feedstock for chemical production, explosives and those sorts of things. That's still very expensive. And also for long distance transport, for fuel cell electric vehicles, a lot of technology work to be done there, but we know what they are. The trick is to drive the cost down. And then the third area is the ones that look much harder. They're almost theoretical. I would right now put the red algae in that category. Some of the other activities there, things to do with the way we make cement is very difficult, right? Steel is pot. We know how to do it with steel. It's still very expensive. So cement, some of these things are difficult. The algae thing, for example, not only is there an issue about the algae itself, because as Ben said, more than 80% of the emissions could be reduced in, at least that's what it looks like in sort of testing so far. The problem is that in Australia, particularly, we have free-range cattle. And you've got to work out, how do I get the algae into the cattle?
Yeah.
Because they only spend a very short amount of their life in a feedlot. So there's a lot of practical issues associated with those sorts of activities, I think. So today we should be doing the things we know about, which are relatively cost-effective, we should be working to drive down the cost of the things we know about that are expensive, and that's where the government's technology investment roadmap comes in. And we should be doing the research and development in those things that are still prospective, but which we will need if we're going to get anywhere near net zero. And that's the way I think about it in those sort of three broad categories.
Yeah. What about nuclear energy, Tony? So Ben and I had a podcast discussion a couple of months ago on nuclear energy, and that came out of some work Ben did when he was doing an internship with it was via ANU, and he ended up spending some time in Matt Canavan's office. Do you have any thoughts on the economics of nuclear? Could that be part of the solution, both here in Australia and globally?
Well, interestingly, you mentioned the economics of nuclear, because it was the economics of nuclear which explained why we don't have nuclear, at least at very early stages of the industry in Australia, because there was a proposal to build a nuclear power station in Victoria in the, I think, the late 60s or early 70s, something like that. And the reason I'm told it didn't go ahead wasn't because of all concerns about nuclear waste or nuclear weapons. It was because it was a lot cheaper to build big coal-fired power stations. So that went pretty well for the next 50 years, right? The challenge with nuclear is that they only come in one size, which is extra, extra, extra large at the moment, bloody expensive, and it's really hard except outside countries where you've got centralized governments who pay for everything to get these put up by the private sector. Even in the UK, where they're building a couple, you know, these things are twice the size of most coal-fired power stations. The rehabilitation costs are very high. The contract that that particular group have written with the British government is very expensive compared to everything else. So why would nuclear ever be part of the equation in Australia? And I think there are two issues or two developments that could trigger all this. One would be if it turns out that as we get beyond where we are today, which is 25% of our electricity coming from renewables, as we go away from gas towards electricity, as we go away from petrol and diesel towards electricity, and we increase the proportion of electricity coming from wind and solar, it will become very difficult to get the last few percent of the electricity coming from wind and solar, because there are periods of time when the wind isn't blowing, the sun isn't shining, and it's bloody cold. And what are you going to do for, you know, periods of a couple of weeks? Really hard. Yeah, we may solve that problem in the next 20 or 30 years, but right now we don't have an answer to that problem that I've seen that makes any credible sense. So that's one.
Yeah.
It might be plan A might turn out to be very hard. The other combination in that would be if small modular nuclear reactors turn out to be cost effective. And there are not just small companies like NuScale in the US, but companies like Rolls-Royce who are convinced that if you could build 100 or 200, 300 megawatt coal-fired nuclear power stations in a factory, you could really drive down the cost dramatically. And you could put them in a box, a bit like,
right,
you know, you may have seen in the last couple of weeks these nuclear submarines that we're talking about buying. You basically stick them in the sub and leave them there for 40 years. I mean, you basically have it's like a power in a box in a sense. So that's prospective. So if they turn out to be commercially viable and as fail-safe as people think, and plan A turns about to be difficult, then I think you've got to allow for nuclear as being something we should look at. And I think we'll see how this goes. But, at the moment I'd say it's less likely, but I'd put those two caveats on it.
Okay, so that was Tony Wood from the Grattan Institute. Now we move on to a prominent critic of net zero. Not everyone is convinced by the net zero push. Queensland Senator Matt Canavan, he's been one of Australia's most prominent critics of net zero. He argues it is more of a slogan than a serious policy, and that Australia risks weakening itself, so we risk weakening our economy compared with countries like China and India, which continue to burn coal. Matt also rejects carbon pricing, an emissions trading scheme. He rejects either a carbon tax or an emissions trading scheme as politically unworkable. He doubts that other countries around the world will live up to their commitments to achieve net zero. And when it comes to coal, Matt argues that Australia's high-quality coal will keep finding buyers even if overall global demand falls. Matt and I spoke in episode 111 in October 2021. Let's hear from Matt now.
In some respects, you know, I actually agree here a lot with Greta Thunberg. Yeah, she gave a speech a month or two ago accusing the Western governments of blah, 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 you know, mouthing slogans. Not exactly sure if she called out net zero particularly, but yeah, net zero emissions is a slogan. It's a buzzword, as I've called it. And I really don't think it's a credible solution. So we can go in, if you'd like, to my views on climate change science, but I do accept up front we should reduce emissions. There's some issue here. But even if you do accept the alarmist predictions, which I don't accept the most alarmist predictions of climate change science, but if you do accept those, this particular policy is not going to be a solution to it. Number one, because there's not really been any country that's mapped out a credible plan to achieve net zero by 2050. And number two, because there is no chance that, in my view, that China, that India, that Russia, that many other developing countries are going to do this. So all this will do, if it is implemented, if people do actually strive to do it, is weaken the countries that sign up, primarily Western developed nations so far, and strengthen countries that don't. And in particular, a case of the Chinese Communist Party, I'm worried about that. I think that's the biggest issue in our region right now, and I don't think it's the right time to be handicapping our own industry while China is threatening and bullying countries in the region.
You accept that there is an issue with climate change, and would there be reason for the globe as a whole, if we could somehow get that agreement and a credible commitments and follow through from the major economies, if we can get that, do you think that there could be justification for, say, a price on carbon or huge investment to really improve the like storage technology so we can have renewables or nuclear power? I mean, what do you see as the way to resolve this?
Well, I don't think carbon prices work. I'll come back to that. But but on the generic question, I mean, the short answer is yes. But I don't see the need to go from where we are today to a net zero outcome in one leap. I mean, that also to me seems like a logical fallacy that comes back to the point that this is really a lot of this is virtue signaling. You know, people are signaling their virtue, their banks or their oil and gas companies who have a bad reputation, and they want to stick a net zero label or net zero wrapping paper over what otherwise has been a lot of unethical practices in the case of banks, for example. You know, to me, if we want to take action, reduce emissions, I mean, everything in life, you're best to do it incrementally. You're best to look, okay, let's reduce emissions by this much and see how we go and whether that can be done. And, you know, we've committed to do that and on track to do that in Australia, to cut our emissions by 26% by 2030. That's not an easy thing to do. And I would argue already it's causing some difficulties in our energy markets in particular. You know, to me, you didn't take that step. And then, so what do we need in 2021? To start thinking about what we're going to do in 2050 before we've even reached what we're going to do in 2030. Got plenty of time then to think about, well, okay, the next few, let's see how this goes and what we should do post that. Assess it, reassess it, look at whether it works or not. Because I think going for these unrealistic goals will cause more damage than the effort. I understand the need to set targets and goals, but you know, you've got to set realistic ones to be successful. I mean, I could set the goal to run a marathon. I probably could do that. I just went for a run the Savo. It was, a, you know, 7 or 8K. Probably if I put my mind to it, I could run a marathon. But if I set a goal to run a marathon under 2 hours, well, that's just stupid. Right? Not going to happen. And I'll probably do more damage to my body or my lifestyle if I'm trying. And that's where net zero, I think, comes into. It's just so fantastical. It's a distraction technique around the real issues of doing something today. Now, in terms of carbon pricing, you asked about, look, I just don't think these schemes have worked elsewhere. And we live in democracies. You've got to adopt policies that are going to get people's support over time. And, you know, if there's one way you want to lose, if you want to lose popular support, put up people's living costs. That's a good, you know, it's a good, if you want to, if you're getting sick of politics and you want to get out of it as a member of parliament, Yeah, adopt a policy to put up someone's living costs. That will usually do the trick. And so it's all well and good for economists. And, you know, I know you well, Gene, and I'm an economist. Sit back and that's the ideal, optimal scenario. It all works in our, when we put, you know, we put this into our marginal rate of substitution curves, this is the best way to get people substituted carbon-free or carbon, lower carbon goods. You've got to work in the real world. And in the real world, what will happen is if you push up people's prices, and yeah, with the idea that, oh, you'll get all these innovations and they'll eventually come down, you're not going to get that far, because in between those periods, you'll have elections, these things called elections, and some political party will pop up, hey, I'll remove that tax and get that, you know, and give you more money, and people will vote for that. So it doesn't work. And you can see that everywhere it's tried, the yellow vests in France, obviously the debates we've had in the past 10 years in this country, in the US, they don't even get to the starting line. I mean, they're still, with a Democrat-controlled Congress, they can't get through, and it doesn't include carbon pricing, but they still can't get through their climate commitments. So I don't think the purest pursuit of carbon pricing policies is a particularly smart tactic, at least if we want to keep democracy, from those who want to see greater climate change action.
Okay. So on other countries around the world, so we really, if anything's going to happen, it needs to be the major economies are the US, China, Japan, EU, and then, I mean, India is increasingly important because of the population's getting richer.
Yep.
You know, second largest country in the world, going to be the largest.
Yep.
Well, what's your, in your assessment, how are these countries performing, or are they likely to even meet net zero? I mean, China claims it's got a net zero by 2060. I mean, how credible do you think that is?
Well, I don't believe them. I mean, if we can't trust China to allow people to inspect the origins of the coronavirus, I'm not sure how we are going to be able to trust them to have climate cops going in and checking things. So, you know, it's hard to judge anyway, because their commitments don't start till after 2030. You know, they don't have any binding commitments until then, so you can't judge them on their performance. I mean, but just put a China aside, have a look at more benign countries like Canada. Canada didn't meet its Kyoto commitments. Canada's emissions are up this century, but for COVID last year, they had a reduction thanks to COVID. But from 2000 to 2019, Canada's emissions grew. And New Zealand's only dropped by a smidgen over that period of time as well. Now, we've had large cuts. I admit we could talk, we would have to go for hours to talk about the fact that we got pretty generous accounting treatment under Kyoto for our land use changes.
Mm.
That's allowed us to have significant cuts in emissions, but most other countries haven't done this. And then the countries that have, give Europe its due, it has met, most countries in Europe and Europe as a whole have met their climate commitments. The UK has reduced its emissions more than any other developed country in the world. But things aren't working out all that well. I mean, yeah, because what's happened there, I would argue, is the accounting treatment of carbon emissions means the UK has sent a lot of its manufacturing to other countries, particularly Asia or Eastern Europe, and it's still consuming the cars and industrial goods, but it just doesn't account for the carbon emissions embodied in those. And then on top of that, it has made radical choices to shut down coal-fired power stations, not expand the North Sea oil fields and ban fracking. And now they're relying on gas from Putin, who's playing hardball over Nord Stream 2. And I just, why would you put yourself as a country in that position where you're reliant on a dictatorial authoritarian regime? And then you got the situation where you got lines at petrol stations, factories are closing in the UK. These things are happening. And then people try and say, oh, it's not net zero, it's other things. It's truck drivers. I mean, give me a break. If the UK had allowed fracking, I mean, at least, mate, we don't know. You never know before you drill in the mining game. So maybe they would have come up nothing. But people reckon they do. They probably do have gas resources because the large coal seams, they have gas at the very least. But they just haven't allowed it to occur. And so if you make those decisions, you become reliant on other countries, and the world's not necessarily a peaceful place. And I don't think you'd want to put yourself in that position.
Now, yes, you're in Rockhampton, and which is a major centre in regional Queensland, and beef and also coal and other mineral resources in the region there. Now, what do you see as the future for coal? Because coal has been such an important part of many of our regional economies, and it's been a very strong contributor to the treasury here in Queensland. But we've got these forecasts, some forecasts, and Tony Wood from Grattan, when I spoke with him the other week, he was talking about how the demand for coal, some people are forecasting that it will fall off a cliff. Do you have any views on what's going to happen with coal?
So it's really important with these types of exercises to define the markets, right?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people who talk about coal don't understand that in the words of John Laws, coal ain't coals. There's not one type of coal. There's lots of different types of coal. And so I'll just, for the purposes of summarising this, it's important at least to distinguish between the global market for coal and the market for Australian coal. So, yes, many people think that the global market for coal will face a precipitous decline. I think most of those forecasts are a little over-aggressive. The International Energy Agency publishes different scenarios, and if they're on their current policy scenario, which means people keep doing what they've already doing in terms of climate, demand or use of coal in the Asia Pacific region actually grows over the next 20 or 30 years under that scenario. If countries obviously adopt, well, not just adopt, but do net zero, then it starts to fall considerably. Given our previous discussion, I'm more in the former camp. I don't think countries are going to do what they say. So they haven't done before, haven't done so far. So I think the demand will remain robust across the world, and that will be good for our coal. However, even if, let's assume Tony Wood's right and there's a precipitous drop in demand for coal across the world, this is where I think the critics really missed the boat. And to give you a bit of a scoop, our modelling, the modelling on the net zero, I asked Angus Taylor this. It hasn't been released yet, despite my best efforts in the Senate this week to support motions from the Labor and other sides. But our modelling does not have different demand curves for different types of coal, which means any projection that comes out of it, I think, is pretty rubbish. Because this is something a lot of people don't understand. Our coal, Australia's coal, is only about 5% of world demand. Right? We are not the major producer of coal in the world. We're, I think, fifth. China, India, US, Russia are all above us. We're fifth in terms of size. And Indonesia is about the same as us. So even if coal demand was to drop by 50%, I don't think that's going to happen over two or three decades, but even if it was to halve, all we have to do is increase our market share from 5% to 10%. We'll still sell exactly the same amount of coal. That's perfectly achievable given the high-quality coal I mentioned before that we've got. It's going to be the last coal mined in the world. If there is going to be a move away from coal, people will continue to start used to use Newcastle coal, given its high quality. Now, I haven't even gone in. We haven't got time to go into the steel making coal, thermal coal, etc. And obviously the steel market, which is most of the coal that comes out of Queensland goes to making steel. Again, there's no alternative right now. And maybe hydrogen will come along, but that's a big, big question mark. I still think there's going to be significant demand for coking coal for generations to come.
Okay, that was my conversation from October 2021. That was an excerpt from it, my chat with my old friend, Senator Matt Canavan. Finally, let's turn to the discussion that I had with John Humphreys on the last Australian Taxpayers Alliance live stream about the Australian government's new target of a 62 to 70% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2035. We discussed whether that goal is even remotely realistic. Let's get into that conversation now.
Yeah, well, you're saying that radical change is needed. I'm concerned that the radical change is coming from the current, the people we've got in power at the moment. Essentially, it's hugely risky, this path that we're going on. We've got the government announcing that we're going to be targeting 62 to 70% reduction in emissions. This is relative to
2005. So this is greenhouse gas emissions, so CO2 equivalent emissions. We're currently probably around 30% down on 2005 levels. And this is this chart I've got here, which has the annual megatons of CO2. And as you'll see, I mean, we're sort of, I haven't got my glasses on, but I think we're about 430 megatons a year. Now, bear in mind that the global amount of CO2 emitted is around 50-something gigatons. So, you know, we're about 1% of, or under 1% of the global emissions. So, you know, that's something we should be thinking about in terms of, what's rational for Australian policy. What's happened is that it looks like we're sort of flatlining around 28 to 29 or 30% below the 2025 level. Now, the government wants us to get to 43% by 2030. They've got some modelling that suggests that we'll get there. A lot of people are sceptical. And now they're saying, oh, let's get to 62 to 70 by 2035. So, you know, it basically means we have to, you know, I think Matt Canavan had a tweet today which said that we have to triple or something the rate that we've been, you know, double or triple the rate at which we've been decarbonizing over the last 5 or 10 years in the next 5 to 10 years to meet these emissions targets, which just seems completely implausible to me. And it's based on this fantasy or this wishful thinking that we're going to take these drastic measures and cut emissions, and China and India are going to follow, because the US, I mean, the US has given up under the Trump administration, but suddenly everyone's going to be inspired by our sacrifice here down under.
Yeah, the geopolitics of the situation are so absurd, as we discussed, I think, last time.
Yeah.
Anyway, previously on this show, we've discussed the geopolitics of it. And the only thing that matters, if you're fully invested in the world is ending, the sun monster is angry at us and it's trying to burn us to death, and so we have to placate the sun monster by taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. If you're fully invested in that narrative, the only game in town is global CO2 emissions, not Australian CO2 emissions. And so the best thing we could do is pass an if-then piece of legislation saying, if you do, we will. And that would be what would potentially instead, it probably still wouldn't make too much difference in the world, but that is the only thing that could potentially add the impetus to world action. And that it also would mean that we take the action if other people do, and we don't wastefully hurt our economy if other people aren't. So that's the geopolitics of this is always absurd. I'm convinced they don't care, right? This is a political issue. They need to be seen to be doing something. It's that old Monty Python skit. We must do something. This is something, so we must do this, which I think sums up a lot of the government, realistically.
Yeah.
And if you put to most of these politicians, you know, what is this going to do on a global stage? They will dodge the question. And I think I think it's because they know that realistically, Australia's emissions aren't the game in global warming. And so then we've got this political need to be seen to be busy. And I'd say where this really ties into our previous conversation is like the only viable way through this sort of economic fiscal collapse of the West is realistically short term. They're not going to cut spending. Taxes, I don't think, can go up. The only option was productivity. But this hurts our productivity. This is exactly the opposite of what you would do for productivity. So instead of a productivity action plan, we've got an anti-productivity action plan. This is going to be spending billions of dollars, mostly off budget, so that the politicians get to hide it because the media don't call them on it. But it's billions of dollars, like tens of billions. I'm underplaying it when I say billions. And then at the end of it, in addition to that, we've got all of these additional regulations on industry. They say they want to decarbonize industry. What they're actually doing is just deindustrializing, which achieves the goal they want, less carbon emissions. But that is not a productivity enhancing reform. So seen through the lens of productivity, this is insane. And like you say, it might be very difficult, but I think the difficulty of it is absurd. Well, not absurd. It's the wrong question, right? If we took seriously the economic danger that we're in, we would be doing everything we can to squeeze every last drop of productivity out of our economy. And yet we're doing this.
So. Yes. And the final chart I want to show is that the chart that illustrates how the big gains that we've had in the, so that how we've got to 30% below 2005 is largely, not entirely, but largely at least, you know, 2/3 to 3/4 of it due to essentially a reduction in land clearing and then so-called, carbon, all of this carbon farming or this locking up land and, saying, oh, well, we're not clearing it. So we're actually now, sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere. So we've got, that's that blue line. That's what they call this. Now, this is a really bizarre abbreviation or acronym. It's LULCF. It's land use change and forestry. It's really bizarre, but that's where all the actions occurred. You see that's flatlined. We're basically, we're essentially plateauing there, and partly this is because of concerns. I think there was a pause in their carbon credits or their ACCU scheme or whatever it was. There were concerns over, the validity of some of those credits. So I think partly that's it. I think they've pushed the limits of that. The pink line up top, that's electricity. That's coming down because of renewables, but there's still quite a lot of way to go. And we know that as we get more renewables, that raises, there's the issue of intermittency. We need more storage or we need more, we need all the poles and wires to connect all of these renewables in remote areas, and that's increasing costs. So higher power prices. That's just to illustrate the scale of the challenge. And we haven't done much on all of these other sources of emissions. So if we're going to have any hope of meeting the government's emissions targets, we'll have to do a lot more on transport and industrial emissions. And, this is where the additional costs are going to come in and cause all sorts of, it's going to sap our productivity. Absolutely.
If we were in a situation of excess wealth and excess productivity and no social disharmony and no political antagonism in the country, perhaps we would have enough excess money to play this game. This seems like a uniquely bad time, because also, they would make the case that once you've finished the energy transition, once you've finished it, the new technology is invented. Inshallah, knockwood, the new technology is invented, comes along, we fully transition, and then we can have relatively cheap, once we've spent the tens of billions of dollars and distorted our economy and regulated some industries out of existence, then we can get into a new equilibrium. And maybe there's even some truth in that. But that means we go through decades of pain at the exact time where the rest of the world is facing a runaway fiscal situation and stagnant productivity, and they're taking that productivity down even further. It's such unfortunate time. Unfortunate's the wrong word, because they're doing it on purpose. But it's such pig-headed misuse of the resources and the timing. You mentioned the areas they haven't made any progress on yet. They've got that in their plan, right? So they're talking about decarbonizing industry. That was the thing I said before. When they say decarbonize industry, effectively it means deindustrialize, because a lot of that's going to happen. The regulations they're going to put on layer on layer on layer on industry to decarbonize it is going to sap productivity out of those industries. And we've already got a downward trend in how much we produce in the country. That's going to be exacerbated by this. Their solution on cars is to get all cars being electric, and then it comes back to decarbonizing the electricity grid. So that's what they hope to see happen there. And maybe that will happen at some stage. I mean, the switch to renewables, if it happened naturally over long enough and it wasn't forced on us in ways that sapped productivity, might be a perfectly normal part of human evolution. But that is not what we're looking at here. This is not a natural evolution we're seeing. This is the government spending billions upon billions and sapping productivity to try and artificially bring about something that is not going to noticeably change the weather.
So there you have it, a range of perspectives on net zero. Nikki Hutley stresses the enormous cost of inaction. Tony Wood highlights the innovations we'll need if we're serious about reaching net zero. Matt Canavan questions whether the whole thing is realistic, especially given China and India's ongoing reliance on fossil fuels. And John Humphreys takes a similar sceptical line, warning that Australia's ambitious targets could come at the expense of productivity and economic growth. The debate is far from settled. What's clear is that the choices we make here in Australia and worldwide, the choices we make on energy and emissions will shape both our economy and our environment for decades to come. A special thanks to Lumo Coffee again for sponsoring this episode. You can get a 10% discount on Lumo. The details are in the show notes. Thanks for listening. I'm Gene Tunney, and I'll catch up with you again next week.